This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Melinda Pencava in Washington. Neil Conan is on assignment in London. Do you have your disaster supply kit assembled and ready to grab in an instant? That 3-day supply of water, the change of clothes, the portable radio, the extra set of car keys? And how about the duct tape and the plastic sheeting to cover your windows in the event of a biological or chemical attack? Those were some of the suggestions laid out yesterday by the Department of Homeland Security, and this came just days after the government said the country should be on a code orange alert. Now, for those who haven't been paying close attention, that's just one hue away from the code red that would be sounded if the country were actually under attack. The Bush administration says it issued the code orange not because of any particular information about an impending attack, but rather as a general caution. And so we have a code orange. But what do we do with this information? How do we prepare ourselves? How do we prepare our families and our homes? And what's expected of our cities and towns under code orange? Can they afford the expense of this tightened security? If you'd like to join the conversation today at Talk of the Nation, our number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. We'd like to know if you take any added precautions and whether you know if your hometown has an emergency plan, and we'll also take your questions about Code Orange. Joining us right now on the phone from his office in Shirlington, Virginia, is Randy Larson. He is director of ANSWER Institute for Homeland Security. It's a think tank that is solely focused on homeland security. Thanks for joining us today, Randy Larson.
Happy to be here.
Well, you know, when the government raised the terrorist threat alert from yellow to orange the other day, they also released recommendations on what individuals can do to prepare for the possibility of a terrorist attack. Can you run through some of them for us? Because I think maybe a lot of people may not have heard this or had not paid as much attention to that.
Yeah, and these are very important things that it's interesting. So much of this is not new. It's the sort of thing, if you would have gone to the FEMA.gov website 2 years ago or RedCross.org website several years ago before 9/11, mm-hmm. you would have found almost all this material on there. It's things that, like here in Washington, D.C., where I live, you know, we never know when a hurricane can come up the coast and take out our electricity for a few days, or we could have an ice storm. These are common sense sorts of things that are very important, even more important now. And that is the most important thing, I think, that I would go in the order, and I sort of follow the Red Cross checklist on this, is I want a communications plan for my family. So I remember what 911 was like because my family didn't have one, and we know the cell phones will probably get over jammed very quickly. I want to know, you know, who's going to pick up the kids from the nursery school? How about if I can't get there? How about if my wife can't get there? Do we have a neighbor? Do we have a friend in the area? Where are we going to go? Do we have a relative in the area if we can't get to our house because something has happened in that part of town? That communications plan is very important, and it can be a great psychological comfort to do that. There's many backup things. I know I couldn't get in touch with my mother after 9/11, finally did it on the internet. But then at home, you know, because in most cases, it's what the Red Cross refers to as shelter in place.
Mm-hmm.
Had a big debate with my wife about this last night because I have a 19-year-old who's in a local college, and she said, well, if something happens, we've got to get her home. And I said, well, you know, if you look at the experts on this, they say maybe, but it may be best for someone to stay sheltered in place other than where I'd like her in my own home, because it's just safe to stay there.
As opposed to getting on the road and perhaps being exposed to something.
You bet. You can be exposed, or believe me, people are going to be driving, you know, probably not in the best defensive driver, you know, techniques out there if something happens. So sometimes it's best just to stay there. But in your home, let's say you're going to shelter in place in our home or in my daughter's apartment or whatever, you know, you should have some sort of container there that you put things in that you really need. And if you go to that redcross.org website, it's just marvelous. Now, Secretary Ridge was talking about have a 3-day supply of food. Maybe I'm a little bit more pessimistic, but frankly, for quite a while, I've had about a 2-week supply of non-perishable food. That's probably too much, but, and by the way, you know, you don't need as many calories as I probably get every day anyway in a crisis, but you need a supply of food, we'll say between 3 days and 2 weeks there at home. You know, peanut butter, crackers, canned tuna, whatever, things that you don't have to worry about keeping refrigeration on. I agree with the three-day supply of water, because I've been studying homeland security and biological warfare since 1994, and I have great confidence in the reliability of our water system in this country. You know, the water that comes out of the lowest rent apartment in Washington, D.C. is safer than the water you buy in stores sometimes, because there's no national standards for bottled water.
But, of course, that's presuming that the water system isn't going to be under attack.
Yeah, but, you know, the reason most of the experts are saying 3 days is because really the only way they could disrupt our water supply is blow up the water treatment plant and physically disrupt water getting to your house. But when you look at the sophisticated system we have of filters and chemical treatments on our water, frankly, I mean, there's many things I worry about homeland security. The water supply is not one of them. Now, if they tapped into the water line going into a large building, yes, they could do something with that. But I think a three-day supply of water is sufficient. I'm not a big fan of candles because I think they represent more of a safety hazard. But batteries for your flashlights, lots of extra batteries. Radios with lots of extra batteries are the most important things.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and then eventually we get down to this thing called plastic sheeting.
The duct tape does stand out, yeah.
And, you know, for a certain extent, I'm sort of happy they did that, and just to be real truthful with you, about a half an hour ago, I got a call from my 80-year-old mother out in Colorado saying, should I go out and buy duct tape? And you know, I'll tell you what I told my mother, no.
Why?
I just don't think it's necessary.
Because the premise here, we should explain, is that, that what the government is saying, that you would have these sheets of plastic, you could put them over your windows and then duct tape yourself in so that poisonous gases or something like that could not get into your house.
And I'm not going to tell anybody not to do it because mm-hmm. Secretary Ridge apparently said it was a good idea.
But why do you think it's a bad one?
I've done it myself. Because, well, first of all, I think that of the people I have talked to since Friday, the majority of them need to focus those efforts on what you and I have been talking about already in sort of a prioritized fashion, because so many people do not have those basic essentials.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it might be smarter to spend your time on the Internet or down at your local library reading some of these websites, redcross.org and FEMA.gov, to see, well, what does a chemical attack really mean? You know, I mean, are you really going to be able to seal out with plastic and duct tape? And I know people have asked me, well, do you go to the basement or do you go to an upper level floor? Well, it depends which gas you're talking about.
Because some
of them are heavier than air and some of them are lighter than air. It gets very complex, okay?
Right.
It's a big challenge for us. I spent 32 years in the military. When we're in a chemical environment, we wear this entire ensemble, it's called, of heavy boots and gloves and many layers and masks. That's what you really need for a chemical environment. Unfortunately,
right.
You know, we don't have that. I don't think people should go out and waste their money on gas masks. A gas attack, a chemical attack, would be a very localized thing. But other attacks could be much larger scale.
Right. Well, Randy Larson, we're going to get right back to you. But right now we have with us the mayor of New Haven, Connecticut, John DeStefano, who is also president of the National League of Cities. Welcome, Mayor DeStefano.
Good to be with you.
Well, when you heard about Code Orange on Friday, what did you do in New Haven?
We covered what are characterized as soft targets, and that's what was advised by the Department of Homeland Security. And for us, on a Thursday when that happened, that meant synagogues with visible patrol. It meant hotels where large gatherings were going on. For us, we're host to Yale University, and there's a Bush family member attending the university and providing coverage there. So
does the city of New Haven have to cover that, or is that something Secret Service takes care of?
On that particular case, the Secret Service has principal responsibility. However, both city police and Yale University police have responsibilities, and the city has responsibilities over the rest of these areas, and that's what we go through. And a big question is, what should we cover? That always is an issue in our minds.
Mm-hmm. And so what does it come down to for you? What do you decide to cover, and what do you have no resources to cover but wish you could?
Well, I think that what we always end up doing is covering some basics, port, places of large gatherings, depending on what's going on in the city at any particular time. I think the increasing trouble for a lot of us is these are very non-specific threats.
Mm-hmm.
So they're sort of everything and anything and, you know, maybe nothing at all. So the challenge to do that we're all facing now is 18 months or 16 months after 9/11. Is coming up with the resources to cover all these events on a continuing basis. And frankly, what's making our heart very difficult is 45 of the states are running significant budget deficits, and they're cutting money to cities and towns.
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand that in New Haven, recently you had to lay off a few police officers.
In New Haven, we're reducing the department, in our case, largely by early retirements. However, in the National League of Cities, we've done a survey, and one out of four cities and towns in America are reducing their police forces due to budget difficulties. And this is a challenge, and it speaks against the things that we know we need to do and must do to secure our communities as we all want to. And the resources aren't there from either the federal government or the state government to do this job, and we're all facing the budget realities that are being forced upon us.
Right. And of course, because the police would be that first line of defense, the police and other emergency personnel.
I think particularly the problem right now is actually in fire safety. These are the folks who are going to respond to a bio or chemical emergency, and they need to be equipped, trained, and not put themselves at risk, and be able to immediately diagnose what a situation is and to be able to respond. And for all that we heard about difficulties with communication equipment in New York City after the attack on New York, cities and towns, departments, and across jurisdictions haven't begun to address that problem. And the problem is going to be this with police and fire services, and I think others. I think we're going to pay attention to the high-profile things. I think what will suffer is basic quality of life. And by that, in America, we've gotten used to crime going down and our streets and neighborhoods being safer. And what we're seeing in my community and many other communities is that the resources that had been committed to make neighborhoods safe through community policing programs that were supported, in fact, by programs like COPS from the federal government are being diminished. At the same time, as we see good partners like the FBI, who had worked with us hard, getting called off to do other jobs. So I think in many instances where the consequence will be just, you know, not the terrorist from overseas, but the terrorist drug dealer.
Well, we do want to take a call here. We have Rita, who is in Newsons, Virginia. Hi there, Rita.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, did you have a question for our guest?
Well, I was going to say that the way we usually prepare for the hurricane, I was affected when we had the last hurricane. I live in Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, like, stuck at home for 2 weeks. So a lot of the essentials that you would need to be at home instead of being out would be one of the things. But when they talk about duct taping the windows and stuff, I think the air conditioning vents and any other kind of vents that would be exposed from outside would be the good things
to have set up.
Rita says is true. We find a lot of the locations that have been preparing for natural disasters are the ones best prepared to respond. However, what they're not well prepared to respond are chemical agents and being able to deal with those kinds of issues.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
One thing that we have to remember, a chemical agent is a terrible thing, but it's really not a weapon of mass destruction. It would be terrible like in a subway system or something like that, as opposed to a biological agent, particularly a contagious one, that could cover a wide area, and it grows. Once the chemical is released, it's pretty much going to stay in that area. There will be some plume where the wind will move it down, but it also dissipates. A biological attack is a completely different thing. And that's one reason, frankly, that I have more food than the 3 days in my house, because if it were a contagious pathogen like a smallpox or a plague, one of the best things to do is stay at home and not be moving around. And so that's why I want to have that sufficient food there.
Right. Well, we will get back to Randy Larson after we take a quick break. But Mayor John DeStefano of New Haven, Connecticut, thank you so much for joining us.
You bet. You guys take care.
Okay. Mayor John DeStefano is the president of the National League of Cities, which is great. Grappling with these issues. Randy Larson is director of ANSWER, the Institute for Homeland Security. It's a think tank focused on homeland security, and we will get back to him, and we will get to more of your calls. If you have a question about Code Orange, about what to do, or what you think might also need to be done, give us a call, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Email address is TOTN@NPR.org. I'm Melinda Pencava. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Melinda Penkava in Washington. Last week, the Bush administration put the country on a heightened level of alert for a possible terrorist attack, and the administration raised the alert from code yellow to code orange. So this hour, we're looking at exactly what that means for you, where you live, and where you work, and what it means for the fire and police departments, schools, hospitals, cities, and towns across the country. And we just want to know how it affects you. Give us a call here. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN@NPR.org. And with us now is Mayor Michael Guido, who is the mayor of Dearborn, Michigan. He's also co-chair of the National League of Cities Working Group on Homeland Security. Welcome, Mayor Guido.
Hi, Melinda. How are you?
Well, you know, as we asked New Haven, Connecticut Mayor John DeStefano a few minutes ago, who is head of the National League of Cities, we're curious what has happened in your city, in Dearborn, Michigan, when you learned last week that the alert had risen from code yellow to code orange. What did you do?
Well, in Dearborn, like other cities around the country, we put out an alert to our regular beat officers. The city's divided into different beats, and each of those beats have soft targets, as Mayor DeStefano mentioned, manufacturing facilities, corporate headquarters, government facilities, religious institutions, and those come up on the list, and they would require more patrol, visible patrol, or park and walks, where the officer would actually get out of the car and check the building.
Mm-hmm. Now, like most cities and towns, you've been working on an emergency preparedness plan since the September 11th attacks a year and a half ago. What plan do you have in place right now?
Well, I think that this plan for potential terrorist attacks really is an extension of the plan that every city has for emergency, whether they're natural or man-made. I think that all of us have a civil defense mentality, if you will. We all had emergency response plans for disasters in our community. So rather than create different emergency response plans for every type of natural or man-made disaster, communities really need to develop one overriding plan. Mm-hmm. That's applicable to most situations. And I think that that's what most of the cities have done. And for the National League of Cities and the group that I co-chair with Mary Paas from Dallas, Texas, our job was to create a template, if you will, of policies, procedures, and protocols of things and situations that cities could institute in their individual communities.
Is money an issue?
Money is always an issue.
Yeah, yeah.
Since September 11th, 2001, cities have paid for any additional patrols or any additional training or any additional equipment out of their city budgets. As you know, the president in the Homeland Security bill allocated $3.5 billion to cities around the United States for Homeland Security, but we have yet to see any of those dollars because the budget has not been approved by Congress. So cities are still waiting, and cities are still paying for it out of their tax revenues that they collect via property tax or any other tax collections.
Right. And with us also this hour is Randy Larson, who is director of ANSWER Institute for Homeland Security. Randy Larson, a question for you. When the head of Homeland Security, Tom Ridge, gave out the government's warning the other day, he mentioned a potential attack could happen because of the Hajj that is going on with pilgrims heading in Saudi Arabia. So what time frame are we talking about here? How realistic is that to pin it to that?
Well, it depends on who interprets your lunar calendar. It's not an exact date, but it ends sometime this week, I believe, on Thursday or Friday. And but it is a collection of things. We have been rounding up some terrorists in Europe, the ones in London. We're making ricin. We found the equipment. We found traces of it, but we did not find the ricin. That is a toxin that comes from castor beans. So that's out there that we're worried about. Some of the ones we rounded up in Italy, were expressing great frustration that they've been unable to attack the American homeland, and there was a concerted effort to do that. You add that together with the Hajj. You add that together with the fact that we're probably going to be at war in 2 to 3 weeks with Iraq. It was a combination of things. The one thing that concerns me is what a couple of your mayors have talked about is I don't see how we can come down off of orange until the war is over. I mean, we're going to be in orange for 2 to 3 months, I think. And it's an enormous strain on the cities for the overtime, for the first responders, the police officers and whatever. And as we said, you know, what, California's $36 billion deficit. How are they covering this? And I don't know, we want to get into the politics of this, but I got to tell you, I'm very frustrated sitting here with a continuing resolution for spending coming out of Congress from the federal government. Right now, the federal government is working on a spending plan that was designed before 9/11. A lot of this money that's supposed to be going to the states, the counties, and the cities, which is the front lines of Homeland Security, is not happening. And if I think a major attack occurs, there will people have to be able to answer to the American citizens, why weren't we doing this? Why was there this fight up on Capitol Hill about how much we're going to spend? Who's tying this up? Mm-hmm. It's a serious concern of mine.
So Michael Guido, mayor of Dearborn, Michigan, are you all making some effort to have Congress give you some money?
Well, I think that both the National League of Cities, the United States Conference of Mayors, and most of the Big Seven, because the states are included in that as well, the National Governors Conference, are all asking the President and Congress to get the funding in place. As I mentioned earlier...
What kind of response are you getting when you ask for that?
Well, I think, like Mr. Larson said, there's a lot of finger-pointing going on. We really... I can't wait until, you know, the Republicans or the Democrats claim victory here. We need to be able to protect our communities, and there has to be a bipartisan support for this.
Mm-hmm. We go to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Srini is in Los Angeles. Hello there.
Hi. I have two-part questions for you, I guess. One is... Given the situation and the alert that has been raised, the travel and especially international travel becomes a very questionable thing. I know government is not going to discourage that, but I mean, realistically, should people travel internationally at all, or should travel at all in long distances? And secondly, the second part of what I wanted to share was... I was in Bhopal when I was a small child, and I was in Bhopal when the actually gas leak happened for the cyanide out of Union Carbide. And with respect to any chemical attack, that's the kind of scenario I visualize. If at all anything can happen, it can happen with the local infrastructure only. And maybe there is some lesson to learn from that, and my suggestion was maybe people should be aware of what kind of chemicals are around them, and local administration should be prepared from that perspective and make people aware of that.
From your experience, Srini, what would you advise people to do?
Well,
as a veteran of that,
in terms of the first part or the second part?
The second part of having been through something like that in Bhopal.
First of all, in my experience, I never found out until the whole event happened. Mm. It happened at night. I just slept through it. I was just lucky, not affected by it. But I think people just need to know what kind of gas is around them. Had people known in Bhopal that there is a cyanide gas around them, and it's heavier than the air, and it just sits there in the environment, the wind direction, and it can be dissolved in water. So. If anybody observes any symptoms, they can immediately jump on to some basic precaution.
Right. Well, let's put this one to Randy Larson.
We did an exercise back in November called Silent Vector, where Senator Sam Nunn played the president. We had Jim Woolsey, former CIA director, Bill Sessions, former FBI director, and Governor Jim Gilmore, former governor of Virginia, played. And we looked at a situation similar to where we are right now with the credible but ambiguous warning about attacks on our infrastructure here in the area. And the first thing that people jump to is say, oh, those nuclear power plants. Well, I don't want to get into debate over whether we should have nuclear power plants, but the fact is they are guarded like Fort Knox when you look at some of the other facilities that your caller is talking about. On the east coast of the United States, there's 41 nuclear power plants. There are 1,400 chemical storage facilities, the type that he is talking about, mm-hmm. that are not well guarded. One thing you want to do is you might find out which ones are in your local community, because if something were to happen, those are the sorts of targets that are cause concern. Now, I'm not sitting here telling the terrorists anything that they don't already know. So when some people are saying, well, there's no means for the terrorists to bring a weapon of mass destruction into the United States, to a certain extent, we already have them within our communities.
Mm-hmm.
All it takes is some conventional explosions to turn them into one of these disasters.
Mayor Guido, do you have any such facilities in your town, and have you like taken steps in that direction?
Well, we have a very large manufacturing facility in mm-hmm. Dearborn. We're the hometown of Henry Ford and the Ford
right.
Motor Company. And so we have a steel plant, we have a manufacturing plant, and obviously industrial gases and chemicals are used in the production of those vehicles. But I think that we really need to look at a more regional approach. I think that no city can have everything they need for every potential disaster, and I think that most cities are going to mutual aid packs and looking at regional approach for homeland security. It's more economical, it's cost effective, there's more personnel that you can throw at an emergency by being able to borrow equipment and manpower from other cities.
Mm-hmm. Melinda, I really would like to comment on that, because that is a marvelous idea. I think the greatest threat our homeland faces is something I call uncontrolled spending. We cannot build a risk-free society. We're going to have to spend a lot of money on homeland security, but we must do it wisely. And that regional approach, not every city or not every county needs all of these capabilities. They need to share them. We're getting ready to do an exercise down in Texas, and something we discovered, there's 180,000 registered nurses in the state of Texas who aren't working in healthcare right now. What an incredible volunteer corps we could have if they were a little bit better organized and had a little bit special training about what they would need to know to respond to a chemical or a biological attack. It would be of great value to this country by using these regional resources, as the mayor said.
Mm-hmm. I just wonder, though, just to be a skeptic about mm-hmm. that, it's well and good to say we can conserve money and have the regional approach, but what if you have two cities in your area that are hit?
We're a big nation, 288 million people, okay, and we have cooperation pacts between about 47 of the states through the National Guard bureaus. Only Wyoming, well, I guess it's 46 states, Wyoming, California, Hawaii, and Alaska aren't. But all the rest of the states have these cooperation pacts where they can send National Guards and other things. We do need some legislation, because in many states, a doctor cannot step across the border to another state and be protected to practice medicine there. But there's some of those things we need to do. But believe me, I think the regional approach is the only way we can afford it. It's really smart.
Mm-hmm.
And Melinda, if I could just add that after September 11th, there was a classic example in New York City. A lot of their fire trucks were demolished in the rubble of the Trade Center, and cities like Dearborn and others sent equipment, sent manpower. As a matter of fact, they had so many people they really didn't know what to do with them. They had equipment from every city, every state. And so I think that if there were an emergency, even if it was two cities in a region, I think there'd be enough help from around the surrounding areas that you could overcome a catastrophe.
Yeah, absolutely. This is not like the Cold War, where the Soviet Union would have sent 10,000 nuclear weapons and then that system wouldn't have worked. These are people who could make a mess or two in one or two cities, but the majority of the nation, the vast majority of the nation would be able to provide assistance, but we have to coordinate. Will the radio frequencies work when they show up? Are the procedures the same? Those are the things we need to work on.
Mm-hmm. And to Srini's initial question about international travel.
I can only speak for myself. Me and my family, we're still traveling right now. We're not going to hide in our houses, okay? Last year, 2002, not a single American died on a passenger-carrying aircraft in the United States. That's just 27,000 takeoffs and landings a day. It's incredible. We cannot allow these folks to shut down our economy.
Well, we do have an email here from Dan in North Carolina, who writes, "This is exactly the kind of discussion the Bush administration wants us to be having, worrying about duct tape to save us from an unspecific threat." And Dan writes, "Nice distraction from the very real threats the administration poses to the nation and to the world." What do you make of that? Michael Guido first. Do you sense that this is a distraction that the government is sending, that people may be getting blasé, if you will, or cynical about these code alerts?
Well, I think that we have to have the discussion, and it may be distracting, or people from a political perspective may think it's a distraction, but I think we have to have it, and I'll tell you why. There were a lot of hearings and finger-pointing after the World Trade Center where people said, gee, the FBI knew, the CIA knew, everyone knew, nobody knew, how come no one told us, why don't they tell us? Now, we're being told you're in an orange alert. These are the precautions you should take. We need to carry on some normalcy, but we can't really become cynical. I think that the government is being over cautious, so that in the event that something happens, no one could really say, hey, we weren't warned. And I think that it's really important to have this dialogue and this discussion. And if we're going to save lives, we need to develop plans and procedures so that we can let our people know, let our citizens know what they can do to protect themselves.
And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go now to the phones. We have with us Mark, who's in Berlin, New Hampshire. Welcome, Mark.
Hi. I have a question regarding, you know, if people don't have duct tape and stuff and all of a sudden the alarm goes off, what happens in biological war and how can we help?
Okay. Randy Larson?
Okay, yeah. Now, see, that's the key. The duct tape and the plastic is for a chemical attack. A biological attack, I always hate that. I was just giving a lecture to a bunch of senior military officers earlier this morning. I said, I hate the term when people say chem-bio because it causes so much confusion.
Because they're two different things.
Things that firefighters and hazardous material teams will respond to, it's going to be very localized. It's very short in duration. Okay, it doesn't spread. Other than just like I say, a plume when the wind blows a little bit, but that dissipates it. A biological attack is like someone bringing an epidemic to your community. That is not police officers and firefighters. Those are public health officers and emergency room technicians and laboratory technicians who respond to that. It's a much different response. And one of the things that we can do that has really made this nation much safer, 18 months ago we only had 15 million doses of smallpox vaccine. Today we have enough for the entire nation. That makes us far better prepared. So you have to understand the difference. There's not a lot that a civilian, one individual, can do about a biological attack other than be prepared to respond to what government officials tell you on the radio to do, to whether you either go get vaccines or go get antibiotics or whatever is prescribed. It's completely different, though, than a chemical attack.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks for your call. And very briefly, we can get Racine in San Antonio. Racine, did you have a question for our guests?
Yeah, I have a very quick question. I'll take my answer off the air. Yeah. We live right outside San Antonio, approximately 45 minutes to an hour away. We live in the country. My son obviously goes to school there. The question I have is, if my husband and I could not reach him in enough time, and would the elementary school that he's at, if we couldn't reach him for a couple days, would they be equipped to handle 500 to 600, obviously, 100 children?
I'm going to put that one to Michael Guido. Michael Guido,
okay,
if you can brief
it. Okay, I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks,
Thank you,
Racine.
Very much.
Well, part of disaster planning is having shelters set up and so forth. And in any situation, whether it's a tornado, hurricane, or whatever, usually public buildings like schools are used for those events, and they're generally prepared. Now, in terms of the amount of food that they would have on hand, you know, I don't think schools store a week's worth of food in every building.
Well, I want to thank Michael Guido, mayor of Dearborn, Michigan, for being with us today, and Randy Larson, the director of Answer Institute for Homeland Security. He spoke to us from his office in Shirlington, Virginia. I want to share this one email from George in Oklahoma. The most powerful survival tool is between the ears. One edition, a $4 harmonica. Learn to play Amazing Grace. This is NPR.